This is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, November 14th, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, we're looking at how unions and employers bargain in Canada and whether it's time for a new approach. Right now, most unions negotiate with one employer at a time, which can make it tough to raise standards across an industry. Some experts are calling for sectoral bargaining, which may help create fairer pay and conditions for everyone. Today on the show, we're joined by Dr. Adam King, Assistant Professor in Labor Studies at the University of Manitoba, to talk about what a move towards sectoral bargaining could mean for workers and the future of Canada's labor movement. Here he is now with Rabble Labor reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga. Take a listen.
Hi, Adam. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
No, it's great to be with you.
And just to get started, could you introduce yourself a little bit?
I'm Adam King. I'm an assistant professor in the Labor Studies program at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. And I also write a weekly column called Class Struggle for The Maple.
So I brought you on today. I know there is an upcoming webinar that's talking about sectoral bargaining. I'm curious, for those who maybe aren't super familiar with the concept, can you give kind of a background on what sectoral bargaining is?
Yeah, sectoral bargaining is a system of union negotiations where contracts are negotiated at the sector or industry level rather than at the workplace level. And that's important because Canada, of course, has a tradition of bargaining what we refer to as enterprise-level contracts or enterprise-level collective agreements. And what that means is that union contracts typically are negotiated between a group of workers and their employer at the level of their workplace. And even when it comes to certifying their union, when you're certifying a new union, that's typically what you're doing. You're organizing a group of workers at a single workplace. Whereas countries that have sectoral bargaining arrangements, when you organize new workers or when new unions are formed, typically they join a sectoral union and sign on to a sectoral agreement. So what that means in practice is that when you have unionized workers, they're not in a sector competing against a bunch of other firms that are non-union. So it creates less of a disincentive for unionization, and it prevents employers in a lot of cases from attacking new unionized workers because there's simply less competition between union and non-union firms.
Bring up an interesting point there about kind of, I guess, this competition between union and non-union firms and how you mentioned like it's almost like a de-incentivizing unionization. Can you expand on that a bit? Explain a bit like what's happening there? How is this competition coming up and how does that affect unionization?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important thing to understand is that in a country like Canada, any new business that opens is automatically default non-union. So that's different from countries that have a sectoral system. Like, let's take Sweden as an example. It's a country that I know best that has a sectoral bargaining system. When a new firm opens in Sweden, the expectation is that that employer will sign on to a sectoral agreement, and those workers will become union members and covered by a collective agreement. It's an assumption that's built into the way the system works. So the co-determination law, which governs labor relations in Sweden, it doesn't compel employers to do this, but most, the vast majority of new employers will do it. And the reason that they do it is because the legislation creates a situation where workers and unions can effectively compel employers to do this on their own. Because if you're joining, let's say you're opening a new logistics firm in Sweden, you want to deliver packages, you're going to need to sign on to the collective agreement. Because if you don't, workers in other sectors that serve your firm, whether it's, you know, people who pick up the trash or they're going to build your buildings or work on your vans, they're all going to be union members, and they can strike you if you don't sign on to that collective agreement. So there's an expectation on employers that they'll sign on, and unions are empowered to compel employers to sign on also. So a perfect example of this is the current strike against Tesla in Sweden. So Tesla doesn't manufacture cars in Sweden, but they do sell a lot of cars there. And so they have mechanics all throughout the country. And Tesla, of course, is notoriously anti-union. It's fighting union campaigns in the United States against its auto workers there. And when it entered Sweden, it refused to sign on to the mechanics collective agreement. Well, now they're being struck, and they're being struck by every worker that touches Tesla in some way. So not just the mechanics, but even the postal workers won't deliver license plates to Tesla dealerships, for example. And they're perfectly allowed to do that in the law. In Canada, you couldn't do anything like that. So there's an entire framework that sort of not just incentivizes unionization, but facilitates it and makes it much easier for workers to support one another and engage in acts of solidarity across industries. And then, of course, that creates a situation where you have between 80 and 90% of workers in unions covered by a collective agreement.
And that's very interesting to see kind of the solidarity that can kind of come out of this kind of arrangement. So I'm curious, you know, we've talked a little bit about it, but could you expand a bit more on what are some of the benefits? What does sectoral bargaining do for workers?
Yeah, I mean, sectoral bargaining at the base level facilitates unionization, so it increases density. A thing to keep in mind is that there's no country in the world that's ever had a majority of workers in unions that doesn't have sectoral bargaining. So countries like Canada that have enterprise level bargaining typically have much lower rates of unionization. So Canada is actually a bit of an outlier. We have 30% of workers in unions, but that's only because we have the public sector virtually at saturation. So 80% of workers in the public sector are union members, but that's also because the public sector bargains sectorally for the most part. So school boards, hospitals, I mean, they don't bargain workplace by workplace, right? They usually bargain at the provincial level sometimes or a regional level, some type of sectoral bargaining. But for the most part, enterprise level countries like Canada, the US, and a few others, they have low levels of unionization. So in general, what that means is that they have higher levels of income inequality because fewer workers are covered by union contracts, and union contracts equalize wages. In Sweden's case, for example, it's less so now, but historically what they aimed for was what's referred to as wage compression, meaning that they were trying to compress the wage scale, make things more equal, which in practice what that meant is that actually workers at the top took less than what they could probably get on the open market, but workers at the bottom got much more than they would get on, you know, in a strict free labor market. So it equalized wages, and it ended up overall raising the wages and working standards of everyone. All the other things that come along with union membership, typically more access to benefits, a wider pension coverage, and importantly, a more equal gender pay regime as well. So gender equality, of course, is much higher in countries with sectoral bargaining than those without sectoral bargaining. So all the things that we typically associate with union status in a country like Canada are just maximized in a country with sectoral bargaining.
So what is it in Canada? Why has this not, what are kind of the factors at play that has led to us, you know, staying at the enterprise level bargaining? What's going on there?
Well, I think there's a lot of things. I mean, the thing that jumps out, of course, and probably stands out as the strongest limitation or opposition to sectoral bargaining is, of course, employers don't like it. A big surprise there. But I think it's important to kind of keep in mind, like, the types of employers that typically oppose sectoral bargaining, which tend to be what we would refer to as low road employers, those that are dependent on a low wage regime, employers who have thin profit margins, where there's not a lot of room for raising the productivity of labor. So you can think of things like retail, wholesale trade, food services, those types of jobs where it's labor intensive, that is, there's not a lot of capital investment, and so there's little room for raising labor productivity. So I think the important thing there to keep in mind or to point out is that in a country like Sweden, the sectoral bargaining model was actually, in a certain sense, meant to also encourage employers to do certain things. And employers that were better in terms of raising the productivity of labor and more committed to making labor productivity investments actually kind of benefited under sectoral bargaining. And the reason for that is that it drives bad employers out of business on purpose. Because if you can't pay the sectoral wage, right, if let's say a food service worker in Canada earns the minimum wage whatever it is in your province, let's say it's $17 an hour. That same worker in a sectoral bargaining system might earn $25 an hour. So what that's going to mean is that the worst employers in the sector are going to be driven out. Only the ones that can survive and pay the $25 an hour can stay. So they're going to be encouraged to make investments in their training of their workers. They're going to raise the productivity of those workers in order to stay in business. So it has a kind of positive investment effect on employers, so which is something to keep in mind. So when you hear employers gripe about the potential of a sectoral bargaining model, it's usually those employers that want their low wage, low road strategy, not the ones that could in fact actually benefit with a little prodding from sectoral bargaining. The other thing in the Canadian case or in other countries with enterprise level bargaining that kind of discourages it is that unions, of course, have not been entirely on board with it. And in part, that's because we just don't have a history or a lot of familiarity with it in Canada. Certain sectors, it's kind of, they've done what's called pattern bargaining, like the auto sector or the steel sector, where you get a contract in one company, and then that becomes the standard that you try to roll out across other companies. That's fairly common, but there's nothing in the legislation that facilitates that. So certain sectors have a history of pattern bargaining, but that's not necessarily the same as sectoral bargaining. And an enterprise level system like ours actually creates competition or incentivizes competition between workers or between unions. Because if you think about it, a new workplace opens. Let's say it's a new auto firm. The unions that typically might represent them, in Canada, that's just Unifor, but imagine if there were a couple. Hotels actually is probably a better example because there are multiple unions that represent hotels. All those unions are effectively in competition for one another to get those workers and their dues money. Right? This sounds a bit like an employer talking point, but it's actually true, right? If you're at an enterprise level, unions are kind of in competition with one another to represent new workers and gain new members. And so that doesn't facilitate a lot of cooperation between unions and coordination across workplaces in a sector. Whereas in a sectoral system, unions might form councils to bargain over workplaces in a sector, or a particular union becomes a sort of specialty union in that sector and then just negotiates at the sectoral level, at the industry level for all workplaces in that sector. So there's a few things that are kind of just built into the structure of an enterprise system that makes it difficult to transition towards sectoral bargaining.
That's interesting. And the aspect there of competitions between unions, I hadn't really considered. I'm curious then how can we, if sectoral bargaining can bring all these benefits, how do we organize towards that? How do we challenge these kinds of tendencies that exist in the current system of bargaining?
It is very challenging to map a system of collectoral bargaining onto a country like Canada, where it's been enterprise level bargaining basically since we've had state recognized collective bargaining since the post-war period. And I think it's important to keep in mind that that system that we put in place that we're sort of still living with, and of course it provides many rights that are important and should be protected, but it depends very much on state recognition, which is different from most sectoral bargaining countries, where most of the, like I said, with the Sweden example, it's kind of voluntary in the sense that when a union wants to cover a new workplace, they don't need to go to the government and have a certification election like we have to have here, right? They compel the employer to sign on, and the expectation is that the employer will, and that's how wages are set. Whereas in Canada, the assumption is the wages are going to be set through individual employment contracts unless a union can organize that employer. That's two different sets of assumptions, and the legislation facilitate those two systems. And so what has to happen in a country like Canada is you find a way to insert a sectoral model in between, I think, those two things, right? So you need something beyond individual employment standards and employment contracts and something that still respects the principles of enterprise level bargaining, because we're not going to overturn the entire Wagner model, as it's referred to, of enterprise level bargaining. So there are proposals out there. The person who I'm doing the webinar with, Dr. Sarah Slynn, has put out a proposal with Mark Rowlandson for a model that would work based on what was tried in New Zealand some years ago, which is perhaps less a sectoral bargaining model and more of a sectoral standard setting model. So it would insert a system between employment standards and enterprise level bargaining that would allow unions to come together in councils and bargain with groups of employers to set higher levels of employment standards, essentially. So you could imagine that at the provincial level, food service workers, for example, might be covered by a sectoral standard setting agreement that would raise their pay and working conditions, improve their working conditions, but wouldn't be exactly the same as being a union member at GM or something like that. So in my mind, that's probably the path toward a more sectoral system in a country like Canada, where you already have an established system of enterprise bargaining that you're not just going to overturn overnight.
Kind of then talking about the current system as well, this is a time of, you know, heightened labor militancy, labor mobilizations. We've seen a ton of strikes. So I'm curious about the strike question in sectoral bargaining. We've seen the federal government rely heavily on Section 107 when there have been these broad, as you mentioned, the public service bargains in a more sectoral way. So when there have been these broad strikes where like huge numbers of people are stopping work. So is there any concern with that in terms of how bargaining and workers might be repressed in a sectoral bargaining model?
Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting question, and it gets into the difference between an enterprise Wagner level model like ours and a sectoral model like, let's say, again, Sweden. So in most sectoral countries, the right to strike is more open than in Canada, because, again, the assumption is that the social partners, as they refer to them, which is maybe not the best term, but the unions and employers associations are working things out themselves, and government kind of steps out of the way. So there isn't such strict limitations and such strict procedural rules for how you strike in those countries. There still are limitations on the right to strike. It's not completely open, but there are fewer than there are in Canada, again, because they don't rely on government to set the terms of collective bargaining to such a degree that we do here. So, for example, you can strike for recognition of your union there. Like, right, if an employer refuses to sign on, like Tesla, to a collective agreement, you can strike them. And not just the group of workers concerned, not just the mechanics. Any group of workers who's at all connected can strike them in solidarity. You can't do that here. And in a lot of other instances, you can strike for political reasons. You can strike over unpaid wages. There's all these different areas where the strike weapon is allowed, or is not restricted, I guess, is a better way to put it. Because the assumption is striking is allowed unless otherwise stated. Whereas in Canada, it's like striking is not allowed unless otherwise stated. It's kind of the reverse, right? And so what we end up with in Canada, of course, is this very strict regime for how you strike and when you can strike. And then on top of that, in addition to all those limitations, we have these instances like you referred to, where governments intervene to trample on even that limited right. So typically that's through back to work legislation, like they've recently done in Alberta. And that was the pattern that governments would use before Section 107 became such a hot topic. But now we even see the federal government, and now we're seeing the government of Quebec look for something similar to a Section 107 with their new Bill 89. So you're seeing governments, they want something even more convenient than back to work legislation, something that they don't have to debate openly in their legislatures or parliament to repress strikes. So there's a real concern there. And so the question then becomes, if we moved toward a sectoral bargaining or a sectoral standard setting arrangement in Canada, what would that mean for the right to strike? So would workers in a sectoral standard setting agreement or covered by one have the right to strike in the same way that workers in an enterprise level collective agreement have the right to strike? And I think that remains an open question. The model that Sarah and Mark have put forward, those workers wouldn't have the same strike rights. And I think that's maybe one limitation. I mean, it fits in with how their overall model is structured. But it's a question. How do you, because again, the right to strike in Canada is charter protected. So it becomes an open question, something that needs further consideration. If we're trying to insert some sort of sectoral arrangement in Canada, what would that mean for those workers' right and ability to strike?
Yeah, so as you're saying, it is kind of an open question still, but there are benefits to sectoral bargaining, as you've also outlined. So what would you say to maybe workers or people who are listening to this, and maybe, you know, it gives them pause to hear this aspect is still open? What would kind of your response to that be?
I think the primary argument for sectoral bargaining is that it extends union density and all the benefits that come along with that. We're living through a period of extremely high income inequality and social inequality overall. And countries with sectoral bargaining have done much better at limiting and reversing those types of social inequalities. And I think that's the primary argument for sectoral bargaining. You know, we don't have hard data on this, but I think we can infer, and I'm probably right to say, that there's a lot more union demand out there. That is, people are much more supportive of unionization than people who are actually members of unionization. So sometimes we refer to this as a representation gap. That is, there are many more people out there who would love to be union members, but aren't or can't, because they happen to be in workplaces that are really hard to organize, right? They're in food services, they're in retail trade, they're in services in some way where it's really difficult to organize a union because your workplace only has 15 or 20 people, right? Or you work for a franchise, and if you organize one of your franchise, what does that mean in the context of there being hundreds or maybe even thousands of them across the country? You're just one little island in a sea of non-union franchises. What good does that do? Right. So there are all kinds of workers out there who could benefit immensely from a system of sectoral bargaining who currently are underserved by the arrangement that we have. Even if they would love to be union members, there's just no mechanism that's usable and practicable that they could actually form a union. And under a sectoral arrangement, they would have a much better chance of gaining access to collective bargaining and all the social goods that come along with that. Higher wages, of course, but all the additional social benefits that are typically associated with union membership or with the ability to collectively bargain.
That's very interesting. It's interesting to see kind of all these ways that this change in how we do bargaining could, you know, benefit. There may be some limitations or things that would still need to be worked out, but there are a lot of interesting aspects to it. We are at our time now, but I know a webinar is coming up soon. I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about that before we close.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a free webinar. It's being put on by the Labor Studies Department at Brock University, and it'll feature me, as I said, and Sarah Slynn. So the webinar will happen on November 19th at 7:30 Eastern Time. And as I said, it's free. Anyone can join. If you search Brock Labor Studies, you'll find the link to sign up.
Adam, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
No, thanks for having me.
That was Adam King, an assistant professor in the Labor Studies program at the University of Manitoba, and Rabble's labor reporter, Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Adam. The link to the webinar mentioned in the interview can be found on the show notes of this episode, and for all of you listening on radio, please visit rabble.ca/podcasts to learn more. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Throughout this week, Rabble has been analyzing the impacts of the federal budget. Last Tuesday, Prime Minister Mark Carney and his Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne presented his government's first budget. That budget saw an increase in spending on Canada's military and on fossil fuel-related projects, while cutting in many other areas. One arm of the federal budget that is seeing cuts is funding for international assistance programs. The Canadian government is reducing its commitment to fund programs that would provide treatment for those suffering from illnesses like AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria around the world. Research from Cooperation Canada shows that funding for international assistance programs actually saves the government money in the long term. International assistance can help support parts of the world experiencing instability and keep them from falling into chaos, and that chaos can lead to situations that require investments of a different kind, like an investment of military force. According to Cooperation Canada, official developmental assistance generates about $1.20 in exports for Canadian businesses and saves roughly $60 for every dollar in potential military costs. Another area of the federal budget that saw cuts were programs aimed at mitigating the climate crisis. Groups such as Climate Action Network Canada and Greenpeace Canada say that the government is failing to spend enough money on meeting targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, while at the same time increasing spending for fossil fuels and polluters like the military. The budget also reduces oversight on the fossil fuel industry, opening the door for greenhouse gas emissions to increase. As well, the budget fails to make significant investment and measures to reduce the impacts of climate change and respond to extreme weather events like flooding and forest fires. Caroline Brouillette, Executive Director of Climate Action Network Canada, said, quote, "This budget shows that austerity applies to efforts to protect people and the planet, but that more money can always be found for military spending and polluting industries," end quote. Labor organizations are warning that the budget does not include enough support for workers. Many Canadian industries continue to feel the impact of tariffs from the U.S., threatening jobs in those industries. The Canadian Labor Congress is arguing that the federal budget does not provide enough support to Canada's employment insurance program, and that cuts to the federal service could mean that if Canadians find themselves suddenly unemployed, that they might have to wait longer to receive help from programs like employment insurance. That being said, there were parts of the budget that the Canadian Labor Congress said were steps in the right direction, like a $75 million investment in the Union Training and Innovation Program, and a newly created tax credit for personal support workers. And finally, columnist Linda McQuaig writes that the federal budget shows that Mark Carney is still a banker at heart, and that his goals are to protect the interests of the wealthy and corporations. Canada needs a populist voice on the left to fight for the interests of workers and everyday Canadians. McQuaig argues that that voice could be NDP leadership candidate Avi Lewis. Lewis, who is a filmmaker and journalist, comes from a line of populist left-wing politicians. His father, Stephen Lewis, and grandfather, David Lewis, were both NDP leaders at the provincial and national level, respectively. They both rallied against corporate greed and corruption in the 1970s. McQuaig says that with the excesses of the corporate class being greater than ever, that Lewis's populism may strike a chord with voters. One of Lewis's proposed policies is a publicly run option for groceries, something that another left-wing populist, Zoran Mamdani, also campaigned on in the New York City mayoral election. Mamdani won that race in a landslide on November 4th. And, as always, you can read about all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.